Hello and welcome to Life Beyond Sport, a podcast where I get to sit with some of society's most extraordinary figures to talk about how sport has shaped their journey in life. From the joy of the rugby pitch to working in the industry for over 25 years, sport has been a central part of my life. Now I've got the pleasure of welcoming some of the finest individuals from across society to ask them, in just three stories, how sport has shaped their lives, their career and their journey. I've never been one to remember stats, names or numbers in sport, something that will become more than obvious at times. But I do care about the achievements, the stories, the moments, the ones that unite us, challenge us, teach us and allow us to celebrate sport's true power. This podcast is about bringing those moments to life. My next guest has won an Olympics, played football with Maradona, cycled with Dave Brailsford, run with Coe and Gabriele Selassie, and he was a British Lion, kind of. Please welcome author, political commentator, mental health campaigner, Alistair Campbell. Alistair, how are you?
I'm all right, Nick. How are you?
Yeah, all right, thank you. So your sporting CV would be considered pretty substantive if you only had one career. So this must have been quite difficult, because I've asked you, and I'll ask all our guests in the coming weeks, to define their key sports stories, three moments that defined their life through sport. Yeah. Must have been quite difficult for you.
Unbelievably hard. I mean, actually, I think it must be a lot harder if you've been a real sportsman or woman, a real athlete, a real footballer, a real manager. Yes, I found it very, very hard. I ended up, I mean, it's not like Desert Island Discus. You get eight there. I mean, three is not very many.
Yeah, I've been unkind to you. I've been unkind.
Yeah, so do you want me to say what they are, or do you want to wait?
No, not yet. No, we'll come on to that. But I think the first thing I wanted to know, for someone who's so deeply passionate and involved in it, were you any good at it when you were a kid?
Were you not great, were you good? No, I think that was part of my problem. I was okay at everything. I was okay at football. I was okay at rugby. I grew up in Yorkshire, but then we moved to Leicester when I was in my early teens, and I got a trial for Leicestershire schools, but I didn't make it.
Was that football or rugby?
Rugby.
Yeah.
I was quite good at cricket, but not great. I was quite good at golf, but not great. But I've always been an amazing football supporter. I've always loved being sort of in the moment. I love big events. I used to play an awful lot. I used to love playing cricket. We had a nice house up in Keighley in Yorkshire. We had quite a big yard outside by the garage. And I used to play whole cricket, 3-day cricket matches, Yorkshire against Lancashire. Boycott and Sharp were opening for Yorkshire. Chris Old was bowling. And I used to do the ball, and then I'd swap and go and hit the shot. I had a score book. Used to do the scores.
This is on your own?
On my own. If my brothers were around, fine. But if they weren't, I'd just play on my own.
And then it takes an amazing creative imagination to play 3 days of cricket on your own.
No, but you can do it in like an hour. Yeah. I always loved it, but I was never great.
Because you were at Bradford Grammar for a while, a kind of well-known sports kind of school, really. But you weren't there for too long.
I was only there for a term, but I'll tell you, the main sporting thing at that was our rugby coach was a guy called Bev Risman, who I think was the first guy to get capped at both rugby league and rugby union.
Yeah, he was, yeah.
So that was quite cool. That was quite cool. And then we moved to Leicester. My dad was a vet. But I actually went to the same school as Gary Lineker and Emil Heskey.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So Gary Lineker was like, he was a bit younger than me, but I remember when I was kind of leaving school, he was like a big deal, you know.
And you never got behind any of the kind of Leicester teams in a way, did you? I mean, it's a big sporting city with its rugby and its football, and there's no hint of that anywhere. It was very much...
No, there isn't. I don't feel great about this, but I didn't like Leicester, and I think the reason wasn't anything about Leicester. It was the fact that we'd moved from somewhere that I did like, which was Yorkshire, where I was growing up. And my whole thing about Burnley, it grew exponentially as we moved away. So yes. I grew up supporting Burnley, and then once we moved away, I became utterly fanatical, and I kept trying to get back. And I think the Burnley thing has always been partly about going back to where I was growing up.
I think let's talk about the love of Burnley, because you know it's in your core, really. It feels very much like it defined you. And you were 3 years old when they won the league in 1960.
Yeah.
For you, it feels like very much about your root, and that community seems very important to you. It's been a very steady force in your life.
Definitely. But I think it's definitely been a thing about feeling part of a constant community. And funny enough, when I was preparing to do this today, there was a detail about when we come to my first sporting moment, there was a detail that I wanted to check. So I went online, and one of the things that came up on YouTube was a document. I'd completely forgotten I did it. I did a documentary in 2009. When we got back into the Premier League, about what the club meant to the town and what it meant to me. And, oh God, I was in tears watching it. It was like, because it's a feel of all the different communities that I'm involved in. That is one that I feel is just kind of, I just feel, and it's mine as well. It's like, you know, Fiona never goes, my partner. Mm. She's not interested in football. My boys have been Burnley fans. Rory's kind of moved off a bit. Callum's still a Burnley fan, but he also likes Marseille and he likes Rangers. And whereas me, the Burnley thing, and I wrote a piece for the New European last week. 20 things I miss about the lockdown. Yeah. Burnley was number one by a mile. By a mile. Amazing. Relatives were 13.
And with that move to Leicester, so this was almost like, it must feel like returning home every time. You must get that same feeling. Every time you go up there, every time you're watching, it must be a sort of a ingrained feeling of returning back to your childhood and returning home.
I think so. And I certainly get, I mean, what I do now when I go is that a friend of mine, Paul Fletcher, who actually used to be one of our players, and he was the chief executive, and he and I have written a novel together about football. And he always picks me up at Preston Station and we drive over. We park at this little, we always park in the same place. And then I always get the same feeling when the first time that I see the ground, I always get this same kind of feeling, and I've had it all my life. And I get the same thing at away games when there are certain people that I've been seeing all my life. Some of them, I've known them so long, I don't know their names, because you get to know them, you know, an away night in Hartlepool or something, you get to know, you might be having a chat on the train coming back, but you never get their name. They know who I am, just because I'm, you know, well known and stuff. But I don't. There are people there. I'm thinking, I've known this guy for like 50, 60 years. Should I ask him his name?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know their names, you know.
Because you just nod and say, "All right, mate," don't you? It's all right, mate.
Yeah, you're all right, mate. How you doing? Yeah. There's one guy I meet. There's a guy called Pete Laughlin, who used to take me to games. His dad was a doctor. My dad was a vet, and he was older than me. Is older than me. He never, ever, ever misses a game, ever. Mm. And he used to take me to games when my dad couldn't take me. Mm. And when I see him now, we have literally exactly the same conversation, which is, how's your mum? How's your dad? How's your mum? How's your dad? And the thing is, they're all dead now, right? But we still, as a laugh, we still have that as a conversation, because we've had it all of us. How's your mum? How's your dad? Oh, fine, fine. Yeah, how's your mum? Fine. How's your dad? Fine.
So we're coming on to your first sporting moment. Do you want to reveal what it is rather than I do? So give us your first defining sporting moment.
Is it related to what we've my first sporting defining moment is, I thought, it's got to be Burnley.
Yeah.
And there are so many games. I mean, I don't know. I've never counted them, but they're in, you know, we're into thousands that I've been to. And I think the one to pick, and maybe this says something about my personality as well, it's the one in May 1987, when we had to beat Orient at home. It's known to every Burnley fan in the world simply as the Orient game.
Yeah.
We had to win to stay in the league. We were at bottom of the fourth division. So as you say, when I first saw Burnley, we were league champions.
Yeah.
Within 25, 26 years, we were 92nd in the league. We'd been relegated, 92nd in the league. And if we lost that game, we were out of the league. And I think it's not impossible that the town would kind of literally have just disintegrated, because the Burnley, there's no club like this in the country. Middlesbrough is the only one that gets close, where roughly more than a quarter of the population actually go. When we played at Wembley in the playoff final, there were 37,000 there. Well, that's kind of over half of the population. I know they don't all come from Burnley, but I'm just giving you a sense of the scale of it. And so I'm picking that game as the defining one, because I think that's the moment when people like me and other people who supported Burnley, the crowds had fallen to about 3,000-4,000 in a pretty good stadium that, you know, in its day had held 57,000. And that was the moment when I think the whole community think, oh my God, we nearly lost that. And we've got to do something about it. So it sort of, it kind of brought it back. And also it was one of those days that was there's a classic piece of footage that was on the news that night. It was on the news, Burnley Survive. And it's of a woman who, she's sitting in the stands and she's just crying her eyes out. And then they cut to the pitch and there's all these fans going absolutely berserk on the pitch. So I've had loads of other great Burnley moments and bad Burnley moments, but that's the one, I think, yeah.
And I think you intimated it as you were about to talk about the game against Orient. Is you've been in, there are other games where you've been sort of 2009 back up to the Premier League, 2016, been in exile for 33 years as a club. Yet you choose a game that's there to avoid relegation. And it's, for me, this reflects a little bit across, and I know you've written a book on winning, so excuse us, is that do you have a greater fear of defeat rather than a greater zest for victory?
I think, I think so. In fact, funny enough, when I wrote the winner's book, which, as you know, was about talking to people in sport, business, politics, what they could take from each other's worlds, and one of the questions I asked everybody in sport was, which of these drives you more, love of winning or fear of defeat? I'm definitely a fear of defeat person.
I do get,
I mean, if you think about the election victories I was involved in, I didn't enjoy any of them. At the moment, I mean, 97 was the worst, because around me I was surrounded by euphoria and I wasn't enjoying it at all. I enjoy now looking back on the fact that we worked so hard that we managed to achieve what we did, but I didn't enjoy it in the moment. Football's the only thing that I really enjoy in the moment. When we score, there's nothing else. That's it.
Is that your own mental health, or is that just nothing does it for you apart from sport?
I think it's a bit of both. I mean, I was depressed in 97. I mean, you know, at the time, I think I was depressed. I really do. Tired, wired, feeling really stressed, not liking a lot of the people around me because of the way they were kind of, you know, into me the whole time, and press and politicians. And so I was wanting out of it to some extent. And the thing about football, because here's the thing about football, I have very, you know, I can talk to somebody like Sean Dyche, the Burnley manager, or Clive Woodward in rugby, or, you know, Brailsford in cycling, and they will remember stuff about games they've been involved in. I have next to no memory of a game that I've seen a week ago. But when I'm in it, there is nothing else in the world that matters. And I think that is that sort of escapism. I think is really important. But I see these in this historical context, I think, is that the reason I picked that game as a defining moment is because I think if we'd lost it, there's a fair chance I wouldn't have had Burnley anymore.
Yeah.
And since we won it, I've had Burnley, and it's been like just an amazing thing. I've made incredible friendships through it with fans, with players, with managers. As I say, two of my sons have become very involved in it as well. We got back into Europe just, you know, a couple of years ago. It's just been such a big part of my life. So that's why I picked that game.
And so leading up to that, you'd been working bloody hard as a journalist, as a young journalist, kind of mixing around, moving between the Mirror and Today, and you'd been clearly working incredibly hard. You'd just started getting engaged in politics as well. You'd also had your breakdown just earlier. You know, do you take some of that personal narrative and feel that 87 was a year of, I suppose, a bit of a release, a rebirth of Alistair Campbell in many ways.
Do you know what? I hadn't even thought of that, because my breakdown was a year before, wasn't it?
Yeah, and then you had Rory was born. And
Rory was born.
And
I guess it must be that. It must be that.
And you've worked, from what I've read, you worked bloody hard on yourself. You had a road to Damascus moment.
Well, I didn't really have a lot of choice, to be honest, because I was in a bad way. Partly drink. I don't think it was all drink, but drink. and the psychosis was very, very scary. I had psychosis. It was very scary.
Yeah.
And it was particularly scary because my older brother, who I was very close to, he had schizophrenia. And I saw how that, he had a good life considering he had schizophrenia, but I saw how that diagnosis ruined his life. And I just thought at the time that I was having this psychotic breakdown, I thought, oh my God, this is it. This is my life utterly ruined.
The fear of depression, the fear of the anxiety, the fear of obsessive disorder is almost as great as the issue itself sometimes.
Yeah, but you see, and then that's where I was lucky, because I ended up in hospital, and combination of Fiona staying with me, a very supportive boss who took me back in a different job from the one that I'd left, good friends, a very good GP. And then I also, I took a decision. I didn't go to AA, but I just took a decision that drink was part of it. And so I stopped. And I didn't touch alcohol for 13 years. And that definitely helped. And then, of course, that I got my life back on an even keel with Fiona. And then we had Rory and then Callum and then, and then Grace. We got three kids. And it just sort of felt... And meanwhile, the political track was becoming much more kind of dominant in my life as well. So, yeah, I think it was a turning point. But it's funny that even though I picked that date, I didn't do it with that in mind. It was like, but now you raise it. I think it speaks to a lot more that was going on in my life, probably.
Yeah, I can imagine you, because you speak about if we lost that. And it feels very catastrophic when you talk about if we'd lost that. When you move on then to the 90s, which the interesting thing about the 90s is that you seem to be so immersed in politics. It seems to be, it's the time when the Premier League started. And of course, your club wasn't there, but you were completely immersed in the job at hand.
Yeah, but I never, I mean, one of my favourite things in my diaries is that in some of the volumes, the indexer, I mean, what a job that is, like indexing non-fiction books. But the indexer in several of them has indexed all the Burnley games I went to. So I still did go to a lot of football. And also, I think I probably was, to some extent, I always tried not to kind of impose my own interests and passions and priorities on the government agenda, which was kind of, really down to Tony and Prescott and Gordon and the politicians that were. But I think maybe on sport, I was so passionate about it that I pushed it very, very hard. You know, from the perspective of this really, really matters. It matters to us as a country. So I did sort of push the sports thing very, very hard as a, even things like one of Tony's first, I think it was his first conference speech or maybe his second, when we did the thing with the head tennis with Kevin Keegan.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can remember at the morning meeting, people saying, this is ridiculous. He's going to look a complete idiot. There's no way he'll be able to do that with Kevin Keegan. And I said, trust me, this is going to work. And what they didn't understand is that if you're as good as Kevin Keegan, he can head the ball to somebody like Tony Blair, like you or I would throw it. Right?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And so that is why, as long as Tony could get it vaguely back to him, it was not going to be that difficult. But I thought that was like that. Alex Ferguson came to a couple of our conferences. I thought was, significant to see us close in with that kind of, they were becoming the, without doubt, the biggest club in the country. So I think that these sporting links, I think they did matter to that sense of the mood that we were trying to generate in the country at the time.
And this is that period where you built your real reputation, really, at the end of it. And the word of no compromise, quite the hard edge that person that for many that don't know you will see you as. And this is kind of, for me, where that you, the sportsman, comes to life more than anything else. Because when you look back, you're so passionate about the teams you pick. And that isn't just Burnley, that's Labour Party. That's...
I've been benched in that one.
No, I know. Yeah. It's the Brexit discussion. It's there's no grey area with you. And it does feel like your entire life, you're in a sports team of different types. And you pick your team and your loyalty to that team, whether it be your Scottish roots and bagpipes, whether it be Burnley, whether it be... seems to be completely uncompromising. Do you think that has, in some ways, compromised you along the way? Because I don't envisage you understanding, doing grey area a great deal. And it feels like you're in a team. This is my team. If you're not on this team, then...
No, but maybe. Look, I'm very tribal. Definitely very tribal. And you're right. You've got most of the tribes. I think also, however, within it, there's an element of insider-outsider. So I often felt that when I was in England, I was viewed as Scottish, and when I was in Scotland, I was viewed as English. Mm. That was definitely a part of my kind of psyche when I was growing up. And likewise, within Labour, I felt a little bit insider-outsider in that as well, because, and I still do now, because I feel that a lot of people in politics, they have the tribalism, but they don't have the absolute ruthless determination to win.
Mm. Not all to avoid losing.
They don't. A lot of them honestly don't mind losing. Mm. It's easier. It's easier to lose. You can feel a bit good about yourself. You know, like Jeremy Corbyn recently saying, "We won the argument." Well, one, you didn't. But even so, even if you did, what good does that do anybody to win an argument if you don't win what the contest that you're in? But no, on the core thing, you know, Labour v Tory, Labour good, Tory bad, Burnley v Blackburn, Burnley good, Blackburn bad, England, Scotland in sport, Scotland good, England bad. I am very tribal like that, yeah.
And has that level of loyalty compromised you along the way? Do you think it's given, have you made some decisions that you think, you know what, that tribalism got in the way or the loyalty got in the way at all? In the decision making?
I don't think so, because I think when you're in politics, you know, you talk about the team. I mean, one of the best things about working with Tony is it was an amazing team. We had an amazing team around him. You know, I got a lot of the kind of coverage because I was the guy that the press saw the whole time, but there were, I mean, a large number of really quite exceptional people. And I think one of Tony's great strengths as a leader was that ability to get the people he wanted and then to use them to get the people they wanted and together to build a phenomenal team. Yeah. And, you know, one of the most extraordinary moments was at the end of his time, when he was coming to the end of his time as Prime Minister, and he had a dinner at Chequers for all the people who'd been there, as it were, right at the start with him. So I joined just after he became leader. There were other people like Angie Hunter and Kate Garvey and Tim Allen who'd been there even before that. Jonathan Powell, Peter Mandelson, David Miliband, Pat McFadden, Peter Hyman, Sarah Hunter, Sally Morgan. We're all sitting around this table down at Chequers having dinner. And what was extraordinary was that, so that's, you know, there's probably about 30 people there. Mm. And look, I was sitting next to Peter Mandelson. We've had all sorts of fallouts over the years, right? But we were all sitting there absolutely as one team. Mm. And that, to some extent, is still the case. I will still speak to Tony several times a week. Think, you know, I still kind of, if he's in a bit of trouble with, you know, some sort of row going on or a media thing or whatever, I will always kind of help him out if I can. And
so how do you create that? What's that one thing that creates that team culture that you had there? And is it, it feels very like it's part of a sports team, but what is there any particular quality that Tony had that allowed that to happen?
I think a lot of it was about his ability to make people feel that he's not a gushing kind of boss. He doesn't sort of say, oh, that was a fantastic piece of work, that I always wants you on to the next thing.
Yeah.
But I think if there was one thing, I mean, this is what the Winner's Book is about, really, is I talk about how, for me, the Holy Trinity is strategy, leadership, and teamship. Mm. You've got to have all three. And I think that what Tony had was an ability to motivate and inspire through his endless rumination about strategy. And I'm the same. I just endlessly want to kind of think about it, talk about it, address it. And then when you've got it, you just go for it.
Execute.
And I think that is a...
Sporting.
I do, yeah. I think a lot of it is about a sporting mindset.
So as you draw that political piece to a close, you move on to... You're leaving to be chief spokesperson. And in 2003, we get to your second sporting, defining sporting moment. Which is...
Well, it's doing the marathon in 2003. Partly because of what it was.
Yeah.
Because it's really funny, you know, people now think that because I do lots of exercise and I've done, you know, things like the marathon and triathlons and big challenges and all that stuff. But I actually wasn't very sporting in terms of my activity. Mm. And it was actually my sons who got me into running. And back to the kind of, you know, do everything by extreme. I went for a run one day on holiday in France and I came back and I said, I'm doing the marathon next year. And I entered it. And then what was extraordinary, because, you know, I don't know if you remember, but 2003, that was in the build up to the Iraq war. So it was very, very, it was difficult on all sorts of levels, personally, politically. It was difficult here at home because Fiona and I weren't getting on because she was totally opposed to the Iraq situation. She was trying to get me to stop doing the job full stop, even before Iraq. It was really, really kind of quite a grim time. And the running became such an important part of me just keeping my head together. So I would go to work, I'd run to work every morning. Mm. My top time was 28 minutes. I was averaging about 32.
Well, Tufnell Park into Downing
Street. Got the Gospel Oak to Downing Street, yeah. And I was running home. So that was about... between 8 and 10 miles every day. And then I would do a long run at the weekend. So that was my training. And it was, I don't think I'd have kept my head together if I hadn't been doing that.
It's funny that you only really discovered the exercise thing. Were you not exercising before that?
Not really, no. I mean, I was just working. I worked and I slept, that was it.
It's kind of strange really when you reflect on that, when you had your breakdown in 86, that the idea that running and keeping fit wouldn't be something a doctor would advise you to do. But
I don't remember them saying that. I think they used to say things like, you know, go for long walks.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. So the running became like a new obsession. And I definitely got that thing of, you know, that thing where you... something chemical kicks in,
yeah, of course, yeah,
when you're running, and then suddenly you've run 5 miles and you can't remember anything about it. And I just used to live for that feeling.
I'd get into work, and
I was usually first in, and I'd get into work, I'd have a shower. That sort of post-exercise feeling, I got absolutely hooked on that. And I do think that was the point at which, and it was important I was doing that, because I was realizing that the kind of the physical illness, mental illness thing, they're so close to each other. You've got to be so careful. I think if you're physically ill, if you're physically fit, I think you've got such an advantage in looking after your own mental health as well.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, we know that now. Well, listen, that marathon was also the one that Paula Radcliffe broke the world record.
Yeah.
You were approximately an hour and 40 minutes behind her.
So, that's not bad. That's not bad. That's a half.
Yes.
I did 3:53:01. And I got on the live coverage. Brendan Foster, he didn't declare his address that he's a very close friend, but he picked me up.
It's bloody agony. The first 10 miles are joyful. The last 6 miles are horrendous. I think is the way.
Yeah, you know, the other thing that happened to me is that I found it so emotional that because I did it and I raised it was somewhere between $500,000 and £1 million. It was a lot.
Amazing.
It really was for then. And I did it for blood cancer because my best friend John Merritt had died of leukemia. And when I was coming down the embankment, and you're right, the last few miles from my bad bit was over Tower Bridge and down over the cobbles at Tower Bridge, and then down the embankment. I hated it.
Yeah.
When I saw Big Ben, and I realized I was getting overwhelmed and I was starting to cry. And I thought, oh my God, what if I'm crying when I cross the line? I've got it. So what I did is I'm quite a big crier anyway, but I forced myself to cry for about 5 minutes as I was running and just got it all out, thinking about John, thinking about, you know, other people who died in my life and what have you, and just got it all out. And the feeling coming over the line was one of the best feelings ever. And the other great story that day, because the Iraq thing was going on, the security bods, they thought it'd be sort of, you know, sensible for me to run with a protection guy just in case anybody had a pop. I lost him at 5 miles.
No way. What, he was ahead of you so far?
No, he was running with me. He was running with me, and I just thought, come on, mate, I'm not going this slow. I won't give his name.
No, don't. He'll never work again. He's probably a bit past it now.
Yeah, he's probably going around the world as an individual, you know, private security guy. So he used to be the SAS.
And he's done the marathon without us to gamble. Or the first 5 miles of it. Yeah. We're on to, at this point of time, you're heading into a slightly different role. But also what's looming around the corner is your third. Well, actually, and I don't know whether it's cheating in any way at all, but you gave me four moments. And I'm sure we'll come on to you
I'm going to play by the rules. I'm picking one.
Okay. So which one are you going to pick?
I think I'm going to pick the moment which I think was the moment that led to Tony Blair saying, we're definitely going for the Olympics.
Oh, go on, tell me about that.
I'll tell you what happened is, I mean, Tessa Jowell, God bless her, she'd been absolutely on it from the word go, but there was a lot of skepticism in the cabinet, a lot. And it was such a big decision just because of the, you know, the cost, the focus, all that stuff. And Tony instinctively wanted to do it from the word go. But he was listening to a lot of the arguments against it. You know, financial, I don't think Gordon was that keen. Remember Alistair Darling, I think, was against. I remember the first, you know, I can't remember who said what, but I remember I recorded in quite detail the first discussion in my diary that night, went home and wrote down who said what. But, you know, it was very, very, very balanced. There was a lot of opposition. And I can remember, I think it came from either Sport UK or Team GB, in nascent form, as it were. And they sent me this folder. I can't remember who delivered it. I can't remember how it came to my desk, but it was a folder of letters, most of them handwritten, sent in by athletes. And I remember Brendan Foster was one of them, Steve Cram, Paula Ratcliffe, Clive Woodward, not Clive Woodward, Steve Redgrave. There were boxers, there were, you know, they weren't all current sports, there were past sports, but there was a big, 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 thick file of letters like that. And I put it into Tony's weekend reading box. He used to have this box, which is like stuff that we thought we'd be interested to see over the weekend. And, you know, I'm not saying 2 + 2 = 4, because it never quite works out like that, but it was interesting. That weekend he came back and he said, look, you know, he said, we'll never forgive ourselves if we don't go for this.
And do you think when you reflect now, and I you know, Tessa, we all miss her, we're a remarkable lady, but when we look back now on the promises that were made around London 2012, we reflect on that now after Brexit, and, you know, it was meant to be this coming together. It feels, I hark back to that personally, to those moments, but it feels like not the defining moment that we thought it was going to be.
No, I agree with that. I think that, I mean, you know, we were, it was quite an odd thing in a way because we'd, you know, gone for it. I was actually in New Zealand with the Lions on the night that the thing was awarded to us in Singapore. So I was out by then. And then the games themselves, of course, you've got a different government. We're out. Tony's gone. Gordon's gone.
Yeah.
But I felt that 2 weeks and the Paralympics as well, that whole kind of period was one of the best moments to be British in our entire lives. The whole feeling of it, the optimism, the hope. And I agree with you. I think it, I just don't think it's endured.
So you mentioned that, you know, when the decision came through, and Singapore was quite a remarkable moment for all of us, really. And more 24 hours later, probably find our lives even greater, 7-7. But you were away. You were away with the British Lions. And I obviously, as a mad rugby fan, hold the Lions in great revere and just find it the greatest bit of rugby, really. Is that and anything involving the All Blacks, I suppose. I wanted to feel whether you felt out of place on that tour. And whether Clive had pushed, Clive Woodward, who was the manager there, had tried to create something new and shiny that actually was something of deep heritage that didn't need reinventing in many ways. And whether that made you feel out of place. Did you feel awkward at all during that? Because you don't seem like a human being that ever feels that awkward. But surely on that tour, there were moments where you thought, what am I bloody doing here? And why? You know, how did I get sold in this? And also, what bit of arrogance made me think I can do it?
No, I never had any doubt that I could contribute something useful.
Yeah.
To that. Just to wind back, look, I completely agree with you that the tour was a failure. But in the end, this is what's so different between sport and politics. It was a failure because there were 3 tests and we lost them all. Okay. To what was probably even Fitzpatrick, Sean Fitzpatrick said, probably the greatest team that's ever played rugby, that New Zealand team at that time. So why did I do it? And did I feel out of place? I did it because so what had happened with me, I'd left in 2003, I was sick to death of politics. I wanted out. Tony wanted me to go back for the 2005 election campaign, which I did. And even though I was happy to do it, I wasn't happy a lot of the time doing it. I wasn't in a good place. And out of this, out of the blue, a guy I'd never had a conversation with in my life, Clive Woodward, phones me up on my mobile as I'm out having a run and asks me if I want to go to New Zealand. And at first I said no. I said to him, Clive, I think you're crazy. I mean, I'm like, you know, I'm the...
He could have chosen someone better.
And he said, well, look, all I'm telling you, he says, and I went and had this meeting with him. It was like 2 old football matches managed in the 70s. We met at Scratchwood service station, had a cup of tea.
Yeah.
And I said, I'll tell you a funny story. This guy came over who worked there and he said, oh, this is really interesting. Can I get a picture of you two together? And Clive says, yeah, of course you can. And I said, hold on a minute, Clive. No, I said, you do a picture with him, do a picture with me. I'll always do a picture together. And he says, you see, that's why I need you.
That was your interview. That was the interview done.
No, so anyway, so I said to him, look, I just think that the media aren't going to buy this. And he said, well, look, I'm doing it for the media. I'll tell you why. They've come to me and they said, the last tour, the media was a shambles. The operation was a shambles. You've got to get a big hitter in. And he said, I went home and I said to my wife, they've told me we've got to get a big hitter. She said, well, why don't you try Alistair Campbell? So that was it. And then, look, Fiona, my daughter, she didn't want me to go. So I partly went because I was looking for a reason after the election not to get further back drawn in.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But I'll tell you what I do accept is that I think I knew from the first test, if you remember when Brian O'Driscoll was spear-tackled.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, yeah.
And what became obvious to me is that Clive wanted some sense of, you know, justice. Mm. He wanted So I was kind of working with him and for him to try and get the truth told about what went on. And it dawned on me about 2 days after that happened that most of the British media were taking the New Zealander side. And I think partly that was because it was me.
Yeah, interesting, yeah.
But the funniest thing was, Stephen Jones is one of who I've stayed friendly with and who's one of the loveliest blokes on the planet. And we used to have such a laugh because we'd go out after, like, say after the second test was lost, and we'd go out into the town wherever we were, in the Cargill or some bloody place, and you know, we'd go out for a walk, we'd go into a bar, and there'd be loads of British and Irish Lions fans there, and Stephen would go, "Come on, guys, now call me the guy, Alistair Campbell, he's lost all the games, it's totally his fault, it's nothing to do with us."
That's taking a bit more responsibility. You've been blamed for a few things in
your
time.
Exactly.
Did you learn anything from the trip? You know, what was your biggest takeaway for you personally at the end of the day?
I'll tell you what I learned. I learned that I probably could never get a job in comms again. I thought that's what it showed to me personally. Mm. And that's fine. I don't mind that at all. But it means, like, doing a job, I think I become the issue so quickly, it's not even worth thinking about. So I don't think about it anymore. And then I think from the players as well, I mean, I learned so much about the humanity of elite sport at that level. Mm. What these guys are doing in terms of their psychology and how they use that and how they improve. I mean, one of the most fascinating conversations I've ever had in my life was, I share a birthday with Johnny Wilkinson. Mm. And we flew out on the night that Liverpool won the Champions League with that amazing comeback, 3-3, came back. And we flew, when we got on the plane, it was half time, they were losing 3-0, whatever it was. And halfway through the air, in the flight, the captain announced that Liverpool won the Champions League. We'll go, wow.
Yeah.
Anyway, as you remember, it was a very large party, sort of 40 players and 20 backroom staff, whatever it was. So we're all kind of in different bits of the plane. Dave Redden, who was the
fitness
conditioning guy, who now works for the England football team, he had given us all this note about the best way to your sleeping pattern on the two. It was a two-stage flight, and when to drink and when to eat and when to sleep and when to watch a film. And it was really kind of useful. And I've used that a lot since, right? His advice on flying and fitness. And the most important thing he said was stay awake in the first leg. Right. There were only two people on that flight who obeyed that. Me and Johnny Wilkinson.
Yeah.
We ended up having this conversation down by the gantry. And I'll tell you, it was just fascinating to talk to him about his mindset, about how he handles relationships alongside sport, about how he trains, about what he learns from failure. I remember thinking, right, so we have two very different people. He's in sport, I'm mainly in politics, born on the same day, May the 25th. And I remember thinking, this is on the flight out, if I get nothing else out of this tour, it's worth it for this.
How fascinating.
Yeah. I had several moments like that with some of the players. I remember sitting next to Martin Williams when Clive Woodward announced the team for the first test. And I knew what it was, but I didn't say anything, obviously. And I was sitting next to Martin Williams, and I remember a visceral feeling of what he was feeling when he saw that his name wasn't there. Mm. And I just thought, that is such kind of... He's only got that because he's really dedicated. And of course, then the other great experience I had was when Clive basically he set me as the sort of man manager to Gavin Henson. That was an experience of the heart.
Yeah.
So I had some great experiences.
In charge of the fake tan, were you? So go on. Let's because I didn't allow you. You shared a changing room with Maradona, which sounds like quite an unbelievable experience. Is that because you were so good?
No, I think, I mean, he obviously wanted to be with me, but no, that was the one that almost made it. Mm. So my three had been Burnley, marathon, and I thought it had to be something to do with the Olympics.
Yeah.
But the one that was kind of always in, I mention Maradona to somebody every single day, every day. It's one of my things. And it was like, and I think, you know, you went back to the question you asked earlier about whether I enjoyed, whether I was any good at sport. I wasn't, compared to people like that. And I always wanted to be. And I think to find at 49 years of age that I was playing in a team that was managed by Ruud Gullit with Schmeichel in goal, and Desai and Mateus and Zola and Ginola and Maradona. It was ridiculous. And the thing about the dressing room with Maradona is that I shared, not did I just share a dressing room with him, I had 40 minutes on the pitch with him, just me and him. Because he was the only one that, I couldn't sleep, and he was the only one up when I got up. And he said, do you want to go up to the ground and have a kick around? Because I've not kicked a ball for 4 days.
Wow.
And it was incredible. It was incredible. Amazing. I just loved it, every second of it. And that was another moment I was just thinking, like, you live, you know, you live for a moment. If you'd have said to me as a child, well, okay, as a child, I didn't know who Maradona was, but if you'd have said to me as a child, you're going to be, one day you're going to play football at Old Trafford with the man who is routinely described as the greatest footballer who ever lived, one of the two, right? Him and Pele, and I played with him as well, by the way. Then I'd have said, that's never going to happen because I'm not good enough. And the fact that it happened was like just...
It's still a testament to a brilliant career, actually. And that's one of the things that comes out. What I've enjoyed is the amount of loyalty and the way you support people around you, including your kids, whether it be, you know, podcasts on football and feminism and everything in between, and Rory and his career, and Callum, and really a huge support to all of them. And sport always. The amazing is your daughter doesn't like sport, but she agreed to put sport in the title of the podcast. So it appears everywhere, but it is lovely to see how you do support as many as you can on your journey.
Yeah, although I think the thing with the children's interesting, because I mean, so like you know 1987, that's when Rory was born, and back then I was on the Sunday Mirror. It was a pretty easy job. I like, you know, maybe flat out 2 days a week, fairly light 3 days a week. The rest of the time I could be with him. By the time Callum was born, Mrs. Thatcher was on her last legs. I was on the Daily Mirror. I was working really hard. By the time Grace was born, as she was a baby, I started working with Tony. So she'd only ever known that full on. And I think the boys were more used to having me around a lot more. And I do think, to be absolutely frank, I think it's people in really busy jobs, they go on about how much time they give to their kids and what have you, but you don't give enough. There's a trade-off, I'm afraid. And I think I sometimes was too, that when you talk about what you learn in life, I mean, remember Alex Ferguson once said this thing about in 97, I was feeling really, really stressed, because what was happening is we were getting close to the election. Everybody around us was thinking these guys are going to win. And they started to treat Tony like he was the prime minister already. So people who would normally have no qualms about going straight to him, they were coming through me. So I was having all the stuff that I was having to do myself anyway, and I could feel this extra pressure coming in. And I remember talking to Alex Ferguson about it, about how do you deal with pressure? And he said what he does in those situations is he literally imagines that he's a racehorse, and he puts his blinkers on, and from the blinkers, it's like a tunnel. You just see a tunnel. And you let them into the tunnel, but you make an instant decision about whether they can stay there. And that, I think, is what sometimes has given me a reputation for being a bit brutal and a bit hard, because I do that. If you come to me and say only you can deal with this, I will say, right, well, tell me in 30 seconds what it is, and I'll decide in 30 seconds whether actually there isn't somebody else who could help me deal with it. And I can remember subsequently, years later, Fiona telling that story and saying sometimes it felt like we weren't allowed in the tunnel.
That's it, yeah.
And I can see why. And that's why now I'm much more, you know, I do try and spend a lot more time with them and do try and, you know, support them. And even though I think you've at the same time, you've got to be honest with them as well when you think they're, you know, not doing what they should or whatever it might be.
Excellent. Well, Alistair, it's been a complete joy, and it's just a fraction of your existence, your sporting life. And
We never did hit in Wazir Makram for four, one bounce into the crowd.
I know, but if we tried to cover off everything, it would be quite hard work. But I think it's brilliant fun talking to you and hearing about your sporting life and how sports impacted your life. So I really appreciate it.
No, I really enjoyed it.
But Alistair, thank you for everything. It's been pleasure. A real joy talking to you.
Brilliant. Thanks, Nick.
So thank you for joining me for the latest episode of Life Beyond Sport. New episodes come out each Monday, so please don't forget to like, subscribe, and follow the podcast on whichever platform you listen on. Thank you very much, and take care out there.